Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefeo on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Welcome to your guest. I'm Jenna Martin Jacobson. Can you hear me?
A little bit.
I
can hear you now. Some things you may have to repeat. It gets a little cut off sometimes.
Okay. I'm retrograde right now. And it's to be messing with a blog talk. Last night I was doing a blog talk show with my brother, and all of a sudden blog talk dumped us. It was blog talk, so you know we just say, okay, well, Mercury retrograde, let it go, but hopefully it'll all be tonight. It's a full moon, and Valentine's Day, so you know it should be a good day. We got more snow here in Illinois, but I'm not complaining. It's still pretty. So anyway, we're going to start out talking about background. You are an artist, a musician, a writer, and managed to find time to be an activist for Palestine. Now,
it just happened.
Well, that's you know, some people might think, wow, you know, a little bit about, you know, the early beginnings and your short-lived career in the Israeli Defense Force?
Yeah, I didn't get to have a career in the Army because I refused to do anything. So they had to spit me out of their system somehow by declaring me unfit or insane in a way, which is not very nice of them. All I said is I like Palestinian people. That was their problem. They were very angry, the psychiatrists, when I said that. They wanted me to work in the nuclear power plant, actually.
Oh.
Yeah, that was their bribe to me, so I will stay.
Oh, if you would have stayed, then okay. I think that you were one of the fortunate actually, because frequently, when people say they're through the Army, they imprison them. I mean,
almost all my friends that I know have been imprisoned.
Yeah.
They just escaped.
How did you escape? I mean, how did...
I went to the psychiatrist and I cried and said I didn't want to be there. And I said I was going to kill myself, so they took away my gun. And then I said I was afraid to be there and said I was feeling threatened, you know, being in a base full of soldiers. Nothing really helped. They wanted me to have a nicer job or move me somewhere else. And then I cried. And said, I like Palestinian people. And they looked at me and they were angry. There was four or five officers. You should have seen them. Luckily, my mom was even there, so she actually yelled at them a bit because she could.
Ah, okay. Because, I mean, like you said, you know, people, they serve time in Israeli jails. So you were one of the first ones. When you got out of the Army, how much longer did you stay in Israel, Sarit?
About 6 months.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was everything okay for you then, though? I mean, like, your friends
Yeah, I was bartender, and my boss was a Mossad guy, And he would laugh and say, I'm not fit for an army. And he was a great boss and like a father to me. I really liked him. He's a great guy to me, you know.
Right.
To me, he was great. So at least he had, you know, those people have a good side, too. They're just so misled.
Well, you know, that's something that we have to remember, and we have to try to keep.
The best boss I ever had. Really.
But
so
we have to
respectful.
Keep reminding people. You know,
one time I was sexually harassed at the job, and he beat up the guy, though.
Ah, see? That whole thing, even though he's in the Mossad, everybody has some good qualities. And
yeah.
We have to keep remembering that. And we have to, you know, keep letting other people know that, because sometimes I see people that are so bitter. And I mean, and they make these horrible remarks just about all Jewish people, you know.
Oh, I see that, yeah.
Yeah. And it's, you know, usually I try to go in and say, well, you know, we're not talking about the Jews. We're talking about Zionists here or whatever, whoever. But
there's no such thing as a Jewish race. It's a religion.
Yeah. Well, that's why people get things confused. But
we come from all races.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure. The Zionists have families that they love and that love them. We can't just say that somebody is pure evil because they're a Zionist.
They're really misled. Some of them are not evil, and some of them are.
Yeah.
Some of them are. They seem that way anyway to me.
Yeah.
They're like, to the Israeli left, like the ones that call to kill the Israeli left, I see them on Facebook, but when I live there, I never hang out with those people. Never met them much. I think fascism is really on the rise there right now. It's so fascist that if you stand for Palestinian rights, they see you as a traitor, because the Palestinians are a total demographic threat to the Israelis. I don't know why. We're all the same people. They don't get
it. But when you've been so brainwashed all your life, it's just a whole other thing because, I grew up in this country and it's like everybody in this country, pretty much. A lot of people, you know, got their heads out of their butt before I did, but once I did, I really see now. And so I understand the whole brainwashing. It's very subtle.
It starts really young.
Exactly. Exactly.
I remember it starting when I was 6 by making us have drills where we go in the bomb shelter. And I was very scared. First time they didn't tell us it was a drill. So it was very scary for a 6-year-old.
My God. I mean, that's traumatic, but that's what they want to do. They want to traumatize you so that...
I was worried about my mom.
Well, see? But that's it. As a very young child... They get
very
you.
Very young.
It's a drill because those evil Palestinians send another one of their homemade rockets that can barely do anything, you know, to it. But it's that kind of a thing, so that it just puts that fear in you immediately. I wanted to
absolutely.
Ask, when you went to Israel, did you come right to the United States?
No, I went to England and France and traveled and even visited Germany. England is much like home for me.
Okay.
I don't know. I've just been there so long. I have a sister who was born there.
Ah.
So
did your whole family go?
No, just me.
Just you. Okay.
I wanted to be somewhere else, and that's somewhere I could be. I knew the language. And I have a European citizenship. Unlike my Palestinian brother who says, I don't have any citizenship at all in his Facebook status the other day. Because all the Israelis are talking of leaving Israel.
Yeah.
They don't like the way the government has turned so fascist.
Yeah.
Beyond belief.
Well,
it's beyond anything an American can even imagine. I think.
An ex-Facebook friend of mine, who's an Israeli, in the ambulance business near the West Bank, he, you know, was pretty much anti-Palestinians, or second-class Palestinians, I should say. But he, even he, wanted to immigrate to the United States. And you know, while he actually was pretty much okay there, but he wanted to come here. But, you know, there's a lot of people around the world that want to come to the United States because they don't quite understand how it is. And it is, in many ways, it's better than some other countries in some ways. In some, it's worse. It's just a big, big, big land, and I think people around the world have heard about it, and so they have their idea of what they can do here. And
I think
find
they love the First Amendment right, which
yeah.
we're slowly losing.
I was going to say, and we would love it too if we still have
yeah. This country has a lot of potential.
It does. It does. And at one point, you know, I can't even quote it, but the Statue of Liberty that France gave to the United States back in the 1800s, and it was that just sort of that call for people to come because, you know, they would pretty much find it here. And some people have worked that way. For other people, it has totally not. I wanted to ask, when you were in Europe then, were you painting then, and were you making music?
I was painting, and I was starting to make a little music. I started making music when I was 28, because I thought, why not? Better late than never.
Okay.
So I taught myself. It's easy, you know. That's why you see so many people playing music. It's actually pretty easy to teach yourself. It's you do it with your feelings. You don't have to think a lot when you play music.
Yeah. Well, you probably need to want to do it. You need to have the passion for it. But you were painting before that, right?
Yeah. It's too much fun to paint. I started pretty young.
Did you paint as a little child? Did you draw?
Oh, yeah, always. I knew I wanted to be a painter when I was like 2.
Oh.
When I saw art, yeah. I was very excited.
When you did come to this country, you studied in Boston, I believe?
Yeah. I went to a couple of schools in Boston and took some classes in London. But I don't have any degrees. I just took a bunch of art classes.
Well, that's what your interest was. So,
yeah, they wanted me to take, like, algebra and boring class.
You have to take
it seemed like a waste of time when I can paint.
Exactly. And now, the cool thing is, now you're actually learning history.
I am. You know, learning a lot of history. It's fascinating.
What is? And a friend of mine, you know, her favorite rant is, we're supposed to learn something from history. And, you know, that's what we're told, but it seems that a lot of humankind hasn't learned anything from the past, unfortunately. But
Totally ignore it. Yeah.
I wanted to say that a very easy, pretty multimedia way to see your art is on YouTube. It's about a 17-minute piece. It's called The Art of Sarit Jacobson by Michael Custer. Your husband put this together.
And oh, yeah, he did.
Yeah.
I remember that.
A lot of your
art. It shows it in different lights.
Well, right, the times of day, and 4 of your songs that you wrote, and Poppy Fields and Wooden Airplane.
Yeah.
Recorded. So that's definitely worth the 7
minutes. It's really, really a good piece. And I wanted to ask you, how would you describe your art?
That's a great question. I think I'm I don't think it has a description. I think it has a little bit of every style. Some paintings are impressionist and some are I've seen this genre of painting in New York in the museum, and they called it Inventing Worlds. I like that. For the my big murals. Yeah, it's like inventing a little world. A lot of impressionist, you know, French, German impressionist painters probably influenced me. But I like a lot of art.
Well, so much of yours seems so. It's so movement oriented. And like
I want it to look like it's dancing. Moving, yeah.
Figures,
absolutely.
Not like figures, I mean, not figures we might recognize. So, yeah, the Impressionist influence.
It reminds me of the 60s a bit, psychedelic sometimes. Some are very psychedelic.
Yeah, so definitely. And but you also paint, you've done, like, self-portraits.
Yeah.
I've seen it. Those are good, too. And unlike a lot of artists who might do it, I don't know, a 2x3 foot canvas or something, yours take up a wall, some of them. You really spread it out there.
Yeah, have fun with it.
Let's see that. That's really life-size. I mean, you...
It's like a little game, trying to make something.
Yeah. Well, have you ever done a mural on, I mean, just like on, you know, like gang bands used to just go out and do a whole building? Have you ever done, like, anything like that outside?
Not yet, no. Mm-hmm. Right now I'm doing a mural inside.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's taking over a year, though. It's really huge. Very time-consuming, but, hey, there's no better way to spend time.
Well, right, because it, I think, is because of so much. I mean, what you do is so intense as an activist, and you've got to have, I know you meditate and exercise and things, and it seems like when things are so intense, you can go, like, back to that. And
oh, yeah. Painting is so fun and relaxing. That's why kids like to do it.
Yeah. Well, and it lets their creativity out, just like yours. And which makes me think, I've never asked you, have you ever taught children any kind of art?
I paint with children if they come over.
Okay.
Then yeah, because lots of children. Our children like art.
Yeah.
They want to.
Yeah, I think you would be very good at that.
My friend's kids. But he picked up music.
I bet it's fun for your friend's kids when they come over then. I mean, there's music all around. There's paintings. You'll paint with them.
I like kids. I get along great with and really young kids. They're natural born artists. I'm jealous of how kids paint. It's so beautiful. I'm really in love with kids art nowadays.
Well, it isn't one of the reasons because nobody's come along and given them a bunch of rules. I mean, they just paint. And
I try to paint like them and I fail.
Well,
sometimes.
You've had those rules put to you, or maybe not rules, but you know what I'm saying. It's
I still save the art I made when I was six.
That's wonderful.
Or my mom saved it, and it's right here.
When you said you were painting, you know, or drawing it too, I was thinking, oh, I bet your mother's got some of those because that's the kind of thing that, you know.
parents hold on to. What do your parents think about your activism?
I don't think they like the risk, but I think they like the cause.
Okay. Yeah. I would think that would be a lot of people. They're very proud of their kids for what they do, but they're terrified for what they do because...
They're just glad I don't live in Israel because they know I'd be protesting every Friday.
Yeah. Berlin and some other places that do the Friday.
I would be going there even though I'm scared to death.
Well, I mean, that's the whole thing. That's what they say, the definition of a brave man or a courageous man or a hero or whatever, however they say it. It's not somebody who doesn't have any fear and does something. It's a person that does have the fear and still does it because they know it's right. So,
yeah, my friend who goes there, she says once you get there, you lose the fear. But she says when she wakes up in the morning, before she even gets up, her heart is shaking with fear. And then when she gets there, you're not so much in fear.
Okay, because once she's there...
Interesting to hear.
Yeah. But she wakes
up. She goes a lot.
She goes every... I mean, she goes, even though her heart's beating as much when she wakes up, she goes.
Yeah, and the soldiers beat her up, and... The settlers throw water on her, and she doesn't know what it is. It's kind of scary.
Right.
Police will arrive in her house in the middle of the night and question her.
Yeah. More terror attacks.
She's a cool woman. She invited them for coffee.
Mm.
And she's so smart, she left them with nothing to say. That's the thing with activists. A lot of them that I know are really smart people.
Yes. There's a certain, I don't know. Yeah, there's just some certain qualities that most of us have in common.
Mm-hmm.
And intelligence seems to be one of them.
Even though there's all kinds of intelligence, you see all kinds of intelligence at the Occupy movement, for example.
Yeah.
By the way,
yeah.
The Occupy Nashville has saved lives this winter because no homeless people have died this winter because we part of us have spoken to churches and make sure the homeless will stay in certain churches. Every year we have a few deaths in Nashville. Well, not this year.
Okay. Good for you guys because that's...
It's not really me. It's some really good... left-wing Christian kids from our movement. They're great, great young people. Give me hope.
You see, that's it. These very, very young people are giving me so much hope because they're quite intelligent, and they don't have all the preconceived ideas maybe that I did growing up, and they see the whole picture. And
that's true. I didn't think of that.
Yeah, they're really...
They're very young. A lot of the people in Occupy that came were students.
Mm-hmm.
And actually from very rich backgrounds. Not
but
poor.
See,
you know,
it.
This is not about poverty anymore. This is just about the fact that you can't have a system that people are poor even though they're working two jobs. It's just something's wrong.
Well, that's it. I mean, common sense tells you. And like you said, I mean, they come from well-to-do backgrounds, not necessarily the 1%, but they come from well-to-do backgrounds, but yet they see the inequality. And
yes.
You know, that was when you read about Buddha, his life, I mean, that was the whole thing. You know, he was in his late 20s. He'd been so protected. He'd never seen... somebody who was really sick or dying or poor or homeless because he was kept sheltered from that. But once he did, he couldn't reconcile his life. And so he left.
his life and went off. So, you know, to try to find out why, and he did lots of meditating and things, but that was his early story. He was a prince. And so, you know, we can't automatically think that because somebody is born into great wealth that they're a complete idiot or, you know, asshole, like one of your songs, Assholes Run the World. You know, sometimes those people with all of that, they just need to be woke up so they
Absolutely.
Can really see, you know, and they see that well, they got all of this from the parents whose business walk on the backs of all these poor people or however, you know, and they realize that this is wrong. So, well, now the weather, well, right now, I guess not, but it is a few degrees warmer. So do you know what's going to go on with Occupy Nashville when the weather gets good, the spring and summer?
There's split into all these little movements that are doing great work. Like helping people who live in slum housing to deal with their landlords and the group that deals with homeless. But otherwise, it's not going really well. There hasn't been any meetings. There's people keeping the website, and they're good people.
Right, and so people keep in touch.
Yes, but it's broken into, a lot of them are in the tar sand blockade right now because that's
okay.
Very important.
Very
I know
important.
Some of them are there, and everyone's very busy with activism with the tar sand blockade or Tennessee for Fair Taxation. I know some girls work there.
Okay, I mean, it's great. So that Occupy was a training ground for a lot of people.
It really was. And they're still doing in the churches some Occupy activities and talking,
yeah.
Especially the ones that take care of the homeless.
Yeah.
And, yeah. What's it called for a woman? A woman priest? One of the girls from the movement just became a priest? Is that what it's called in English? Excuse my English.
Maybe. Well, it would depend on what church it is. If he was a priest or a minister.
That's great to see the left-wing Christians. They're beautiful.
Okay, good.
They're beautiful. And,
I don't have a thing against really any religious or religious people, except the ones that think that their way is the only way.
Yeah, I think they lost the way.
That's where I have, sometimes, even then, I mean, if they're not irritating me, I'm good. I don't understand people who hate all religions and are bitter. I think that there must be something from their background or
exactly.
I don't know.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what it is.
Otherwise, you know, why would you be bitter about something? If you don't like the religion, well, don't go to the church. Don't go to the mosque. I mean, you know, nobody's making you join. So,
I think it's usually people who have been raped in the church or something.
Yeah, or they've heard some story or something. There's, I mean, there's many reasons as there are people. But no, so much just to let live. But what then songs? Because you write most of the songs that you perform now, right?
Yeah, I perform at home just right now, but sometimes I'll go out, not often.
Yeah. But you have a band that you work with sometimes, or you did?
Yeah, sometimes.
So just friends right now? I mean, it's like you're not really...
Yeah,
performing.
I play with Michael.
Yeah.
Michael Custer, he plays guitar or bass, but he plays bass for me.
Okay. Now, did he...
And we... Yes.
Did he play music before he met you?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
we're
okay.
All,
I know.
He played a lot of music.
All right.
A lot of bands performed a lot.
Yeah, we're still hoping to get him to run for office or something.
Yeah, if we didn't have a system that you need $5 million to run,
yeah,
more than that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, that's a friend of mine recently, well, last year, got elected to some local where she lives ward. I forget what they call the people there. It's not like a ward thing. I don't know. I mean, probably like one of the lowest rungs that you can be elected to. But she's been doing some interesting things. And, you know, I guess that this kind of thing still has to be done. I mean, I'm really waiting for the complete system to be overthrown because is broken, and I'm tired of Band-Aids. But until then, I mean...
I'm tired of Band-Aids, too. That's a good one.
No? But until then, we do have to have some good people in positions of power, however large or small it is, to steer us that way. So, unfortunately, that money thing is,
in the way.
Oh, yeah, you can run for the school board. You can do different things in towns that doesn't take a lot of money. I mean, like my friend, there was no money there. But to get up to higher offices to run for, you do have to have a lot of money. And the corporations give it to both the,
both parties.
And the Democrats. They give it to them. They give it to the Uniparty. They give it to both of them. Because they don't care, because they know they're going to buy off whoever wins anyway.
It's all business to them. We need to be organized like them.
Yeah. I mean, we actually need some fresh people as leaders who are not greedy and who won't cave in when they offer bribes. And, I mean, it's a hard thing. I understand that. It's hard. It's like, oh, well, you know, we'll make sure your kid gets to whatever school and, you know, you won't have to pay a dime and all that. And we know colleges are pretty expensive. And so for some people, that would be a really good lure. And then, you know, it just goes on. And the travel. And you know how AIPAC sends a lot of our senators and representatives. They give them free trips to Israel.
And by the way, the money that AIPAC sends to Israel does not go to the poor Israeli and Palestinian people. It doesn't.
No.
It goes to the military-industrial complex. The people who live in Israel are suffering from poverty more than any other time in the history of the country. No jobs, violence, despair. We had 10 cases of self-mutilation in the last year and a half.
Is it 10 now? Oh, my God.
Yes.
Okay, those last
and
two.
And some failed because they got saved, so they don't count. There's a lot of rape there, a lot of pedophilia.
Yes.
And the occupation does corrupt. I remember that boys before going to the army had like a different soul. Once they go to the army, their soul changes. I remember seeing it as a teenager and not knowing why.
Wow.
It's very intense.
It would just be like
that you've always known, suddenly you don't know them anymore. They act like in a way that you don't know them anymore.
Yeah. Well, because they've been brainwashed and then they've done things that...
And they get depressed.
I saw you had sent me a movie.
Yes, I did. About the stone.
Yes, Guy Batavia, who you had on your show, an activist. I mean, oh my God, love that man.
He has to walk children to school in Palestine because settlers attack them. Settlers even shot one once.
Yeah.
So, It's very dangerous.
I mean,
actually, he's been attacked by settlers lately a lot. I just posted it on my Facebook. And settlers were attacking him, the soldiers stood there and watched.
They stood and watched, yeah.
Yes.
But he keeps doing it. And that part of the movie, it was just like, my heart was like, oh, my God, because they sometimes the soldiers walk out to these children to school, but sometimes they don't get there to pick them up in time to come to walk them back.
Yes.
And then they showed Guy, Batavia, walking. You hear this?
And all he had was a camera.
Israeli man walking the Palestinian at home to try to save them from the settlers. And, I mean, you know, it
makes me want to move back and do these things, but it's very scary.
Right, there's so much to do, but it's, and then in the same movie.
But I have to be here right now.
Well, the man who started Breaking the Silence was in the movie.
Yes, Shaul, Shaul, Yehuda
Shaul, I think. They just don't want to talk about things they did. And,
yes.
But now with Breaking the Silence, it's he was definitely, I forget what, but he's in the army. But
he was a commanding officer in the occupied territories.
Yes. He
did a lot of.
The line is
messed up.
He knows what them and what they're going through and how they're trying. Well, they're trying to discover their soul again, because you said like what you went to school with and knew, they seem to just lose their soul. But Breaking the Silence, people are getting it back.
Yes, they are. I'm so glad they started this organization. It's very censored in Israel. I noticed they're not talking about it much. I wonder how they managed to brainwash the people to the point where they don't even want to listen to Breaking the Silence there.
Well,
like,
I mean,
here?
Brainwashed so much and from an early age. You know, we've at least all the activists, and we posted occasionally, and we've seen those pictures of the Israeli kids riding something on like
missiles.
Yeah. So when you start your children out that young, and even younger, it takes some great something to break them out of that.
Yeah, some of them break out of it, some don't. Probably
yeah.
Up to a psychology expert.
Well, another thing that gives me hope, and I believe it was in that movie too, there was an Israeli woman who is a lawyer, and she works pretty much exclusively with Palestinians. And she deals with, you know, like the children that have been arrested and everything.
How nice. Yes, I remember.
Which is a whole other... in this movie, it had a five-year-old boy that they arrested. I mean, these little kids crying and crying, and it turned out they did end up keeping him for just a couple hours. No little child. They said he threw a stone. No little child should ever have to go through that. But
it's so crazy.
Well, it's just another way of terrifying people.
In Breaking the Silence, they use the excuse of saying, a soldier admitted that they say children are throwing stones even when they're not, just to instill fear. Their goal is to instill fear to make them leave. They want their home. They want their land. It's simple.
Yeah. I mean, and if you know, the Palestinians are quandary, because even if they wanted to leave, they don't let them. They're trying to run them out without giving them any place to go.
It's insane. They have no citizenship. It's hard to go somewhere where you have hardly any identity.
Right. Yes, and I'm not sure, but if like the Israeli
women who are marrying Palestinian men or Palestinian women who are marrying Israeli men, do they lose their Israeli citizenship if they marry the other?
I do not know. They're not legally considered married because to be married legally in Israel, you have to marry a Jew, and only marriage that is legal there is rabbinate over at the rabbinates, the religious marriage. That's the only marriage you can have there, and it's terrible because the laws are not good for women.
Okay. Well, what about the Christians? I mean, there's a percentage of Christians there, so if a Christian
marriage
is
not Christian, acknowledged by the state, I guess.
Oh my God! So they can get married in their church or whatever, but they're still not. State doesn't own.
Yes, and there's 10% of the citizens of that country are Christian, and they're to the regular Israelis, they're like the Muslims. They don't see a difference. They're not big fans of. They're told bad things about the Islam religion in Israel that are not true at all. I've spoken to some Islam teachers lately. It seems like everything they're told about Islam is wrong. Everything they're told about Christianity is wrong.
Yeah.
They need to teach theology in all schools so people will know what all religions are. They're all pretty much wanting the same thing, to do good and be good.
The core of the religion is all the same. It has to do with peace and compassion and kindness. And
even the Jewish religion. But.
Yeah. But mankind has totally changed that out of greed and control issues and things. So the religion, I mean, that's why we can't blame religion. We can only blame the false practitioners of it who just don't get it, religion. But then,
I think people
listen
to the false prophets too much.
Yeah.
I see a lot of false prophets speaking on TV on Saturday or Sunday in the churches here, and they sound a little insane to me.
I don't miss my TV.
It's crazy. I can only handle about 5 minutes and I change the channel and I shake my head.
But that's it. There's so many things that, you know, when people talk about, oh, did you see or are you going to watch or whatever, and it's just like Obama's State of the Union. You know, I told people
I didn't watch it.
Oh, no. I said in the first place, I don't like the Carolina would be because I can't stand the lies. And I said, you know, I'll find out whatever. The next day, I'll find out what he didn't say, what lies he told. You know, it's like I wasn't going to sit there and watch it firsthand. I can't do that. Just like you say, 5 minutes of those preachers is all you can handle.
It's hard.
Just, yeah. And it's one of those things, you know, we choose what we're going to see and get stressed over. And so mine will be, I'll watch the videos and movies of Palestine that make me ill, but I feel like I need to know what's happening. And so I'll watch those and then go for a walk or go cook something. Like you go paint then, or you go play some music. Because we've got to keep a balance going here. What would you say, like if you were to define music right now, what would you call it?
The temple of my soul. Music's like my church.
Okay.
It's like a spiritual practice.
Mm-hmm. Because it is well, it's sort of like Amnon in Israel. I mean,
it's the language of the soul,
right? Which happens to be pretty much anti-government and anti-idiots. I
wouldn't mind a government that's by the people for the people.
Well, exactly.
That would be amazing.
A real
utopia.
A real people's government would be a wonderful thing.
That's all we need to do.
It will happen, but
we need to put those corporations in their place.
Yeah. But besides, between here and there, there's going to be some real issues, I think. But so what now, you and Michael are playing music at home, and maybe if a friend comes over, but you don't have any plans right now to like an album or CD or anything?
Not yet.
No, okay.
Very expensive to record. If whenever a sum of money lands on me, I'll go record a few songs.
There you go. Yeah, everything. But I do know more and more musicians are self-producing.
That's hard. I'm totally.
You know, it seems like a better way to do than to end up with a big company that tells people what to write and what to sing, and
absolutely,
you know, takes over your life. So that the self-produced, just like self-published books and all this, you may not make a ton of money, but you're not in it to make a ton of money either, and you still have your friends. So I think that's a good thing. Now you do write songs. Do you blogging, or do you write anything else, poetry that you haven't set to music? Or
I have books that I saved from my past. Sometimes I go through them and like things. I'm kind of shy about sharing poetry. It's so personal. Mm. I should. One day I'll get the courage to put it out there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think poetry is probably one of the most personal forms of writing that a person...
Yeah, absolutely. I even see, like, writings about Palestine and Israel from when I was in my early 20s.
Mm.
Before I really knew much, and it's really good. I will send it to you.
Okay, thank you. It's funny how when we first start finding out, some of us just get it, and we don't really think that much about it, but we get it. And then because we do, we start finding out more and more, and it's like, my God. And, yeah, you look back and you say, I was so right back then. I didn't know.
Absolutely.
I was so right. Yeah.
What we feel is usually true.
Right. Yeah, that intuition, that gut feeling is like, That was it.
That's all our intelligence combined trying to shout at us.
Yeah.
In our senses, yes.
And we need...
To me, it's like watching brothers fighting. What's happening there is just like a civil war, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is. Yeah.
I can't even tell the difference who's who when you're there. We all look the same.
But that's what, I mean, to me it's like, I don't know how people, who are there, and some people are so sure, I mean, they can tell, and okay, those Palestinians, blah, blah. I mean, if people weren't, you know, like if the ladies weren't dressing in the scarves and everything, I mean, would they be able to tell the difference? I don't know.
Never. I could never know.
See, and you lived there for
I hang out with people, and then 2 hours later they tell me they're Palestinian. I didn't care.
Well, I mean, that's because
I thought
you
it
like
was great. I was glad they put up with me. they think the Israelis are really mean after what they go through.
Yeah.
It's nice to see they want peace. Gives
you
me hope.
Feel that you almost want to apologize and you know, and say, well, I'm
and give them a hug.
Yeah, like, I'm not like that. You know me. You know I'm not.
Yes.
Because you're so ashamed and embarrassed of the way that...
It's
like,
very embarrassing.
Yeah.
Especially the more you know. A lot of people haven't really seen the daily life there. What they have to go through on a daily basis is so humiliating. I can't imagine going through one of those checkpoints even once.
No,
it's horrible.
if you're going off to work, I mean, like you have to leave home at 2:30 in the morning because the checkpoint, by the time you get there and they stick you around until, you know, you get through, maybe you get to work on time kind of thing. I mean, they try their best to make it rough on people.
Absolutely. And if you're sick, going through one of those checkpoints is worse than hell. People die in those checkpoints.
Yeah.
Well, they don't let, the other day they didn't let a pregnant woman pass.
See?
She was diabetic and everything. Some of them are not humane, some of them are, but you can't put a faith of people on an army. They're just kids. They don't know what they're doing yet.
That's it. When you see the pictures of them, they are. I mean, they're young. They're 18 years old, and they're doing what they've been told and what they've been brainwashed to do. And so it's no wonder that it's been suicide, and it's no wonder that breaking the silence is growing.
It's growing fast. And the people that give testimonies pay, because then no one will employ you unless you're really lucky.
Yeah.
Your family might disown you.
Yeah.
Parts of your family will, for sure.
Well, so they face the same thing that the other activists are facing. I mean, loss of jobs, loss of family. And yet they're doing it, just like Guy, like Amnon, you know, it's like, wow, these are
everyone does it in their own way, yes.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
So, however you can do it. We're going to close out with your song, Shame on You, Israel.
Oh, how wonderful.
Yeah. Wonderful. And I want to thank you so much.
A pleasure.
AACOBSOHN. On Facebook, and she is a very vocal person.
I know. Yeah.
And always in trouble with Facebook and different groups. But that's okay. That's the way it should be. So hope to have you back and do some of your other songs. But right now we're going to have you and Fields and the Wooden Airplane. Thank you, Israel. Thank you, Sarit. Happy Valentine's Day.
Pleasure. Happy Valentine's Day, everyone.
Okay. That was Sarit Jacobs and Poppy Fields and the Wooden Airplane with Shame on You, Israel. You're listening to Aramarte Fio on blogtalkradio.com. Now we have an angel blade, Demogorg. Recorded because of time difference, but at the point, some things that I think we all really should consider. It makes sense once you get a piece of the puzzle, yes, together. So here is good evening, everyone, and tonight we have Ole Demogorg with us. He's coming to us from Spain, and he has a very interesting story of why he's in Spain, being of Danish heritage. But good evening, Ole. It's good to have you.
Good evening, Lutanis. I'm very privileged to be on your show. Thank you.
Well, our time thing is a little, I'm saying evening, and it's morning for me and afternoon for you. So anyway, we actually do know people that, you know, what time of day it is, but we're doing it this way. Olay's been involved for years and years, 25 or 30 years, with different kinds of what are called conspiracy theories. And we know that a lot of the conspiracies are truly realities. So we connected over the JFK 50-year, anniversary of his murder. But then I found out all of these other things that Olay's been involved in. And he is an award-winning author, a former journalist, investigator. He's an inventor, and he's really determined to shed light on the truth. And the truth seems to be that the same elites have been involved in so many of these assassinations around the world, in the so-called conspiracies. We're really being run by a very, very small group of multinationalists, it seems. And I know that you grew up in Denmark and you lived in Sweden. You were quite happy there. But would you just tell us, Olay, why you had to leave Sweden?
Yeah, it was because in 1986, the Swedish prime minister was shot down. By a lone crazy guy, which is always the case when they carry out these assassinations, the way they blame it on one lone patsy. Right. And before that, I'd spent since the early 1980s, I spent thousands and thousands of hours looking into the JFK assassination, the Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and so on. And then when this happened in Sweden with the Swedish prime minister, I thought that I lived in a free country with a police that I could trust, with a government that wasn't corrupted, and we were being told quite early on that it wasn't a conspiracy, but a job that was carried out by a lone crazy guy that had escaped. So I truly believed what I was being told. But then after a year or so of this investigation not leading anywhere at all, and in the meantime, me studying the JFK, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King into extreme details. I mean, I would say I was obsessed with it almost. I read at least maybe a couple of hundred books in the JFK assassination and so on.
Yeah.
But what I found was that it was almost like the power behind these things were using almost like a template. And I think this template was more or less put together by the old Romans on how to carry out a political assassination and without the population discovering what's going on, but believing or being told that it's the work of a lone crazy guy when it's actually a political overtake and sometimes even a coup d'etat of that country. And so while studying these assassinations, it was, like I say, it was almost like a bullet point list that I found out that they're almost following this to the dot in all of these different assassinations, even though the carrying out of it can look different. Mm-hmm. They still follow the same bullet point.
Right. It's still the same checklist then, but they vary it enough to have...
They vary it very little.
Well, it's, I mean, as far as who does it or how they how
that
it's
is
perceived.
True.
Yeah.
That is true. But then after a while, I started seeing that exactly the same thing was happening in Sweden, which just I just couldn't believe it, because I thought, like I said, I thought I grew up in a totally different country. And I thought, how is it possible that an assassination in Sweden can follow exactly the same template as in the States or in Chile or in South Africa and so on? So I started really looking at it from a totally different point of view, with the idea that maybe these could even be connected, because otherwise how would they be able to know what to do and so on. And I came to a point where I was able to proceed what was going to happen in Sweden with the investigation and so on. So I could say that within the next 2-3 weeks, they will come out with this. When I looked at the other assassinations, then I knew that the investigation would do exactly this. And right I was, because within the next 2-3 weeks, they did exactly the same in Sweden. And that really freaked me out, because I thought, my God, what is going on here? And so from then on, I just got so into these. I moved to Stockholm right away after the assassination, and I started my own private investigation together with a few friends, and just trying to find out what really happened. What happened? Because it was, like my book is called Coup d'etat in Slow Motion, it was like there had been a coup d'etat, but that it was carried out in slow motion after the assassination itself, so that no one really noticed that it was actually an overtake of power, mm-hmm. and that the people who are now in power there are the people that were part of the assassination.
Right.
And so from then on, when I started seeing that they were actually connected, like I say, I spent almost 30 years doing this, and what I've been able to track down is, I've been able to not even find this exact same power elite behind all of these big events. I would say more or less all of them. But I also found out that they've even used the same assassins in many, many, many of these assassinations.
Wow.
And so I tracked them down one by one, and I got names, photos, all of these things. And I can go into big details if you're interested.
That does surprise me, that the actual same humans were used. I guess so. Why not? I mean, if you're a success at what you do, just, you know.
I heard an interview with one of them that's heard a whistleblower. And he was asked exactly the same question. He was like, but why on earth would you use the same people? And he said, why change a winning team?
Exactly.
And these are people that they're highly skilled in their area, and you bring in the same experts
sure.
to carry it out, and they're just being flown from country to country and carry out these tasks. Because these are people that... they're just very skilled killers. I mean, they could have been skilled technicians for nuclear power plants or whatever. Mm-hmm. You would get the best. And in this area,
sure.
we're talking about killers, and they are very, very...
Are we talking about, like, CIA kind of killers?
Yeah, very much CIA.
I can tell you,
if you want to, I can tell
sure,
you about
please.
This group, when it was created and so on.
Please.
It was in the late 1950s, President Dwight Eisenhower, he asked his vice president, a man by the name of Richard Nixon, to put together a team of highly skilled assassins, because what they wanted was to use this like a task force to be able to carry out hits on other international leaders, and especially Fidel Castro at that time was a big problem for them. So in the very early 60s, this group was a group of 40 people to start with, and it was called Operation 40 or Group 40. And this group consisted of mostly exiled Cuban former military police officers. They were from the Air Force as well, that had left Cuba, very, very hateful against Fidel Castro and so on.
Oh.
So it was a group of very hard men, very violent people, disciplined, highly disciplined and so on. This task group was put together with these exiled Cubans mostly, and then people from the CIA. And the people from the CIA were people like E. Howard Hunt, which I'm sure many people recognize from the Watergate burglar. He was also deeply involved in the JFK assassination and many, many, many other operations. Another one was Ted Shackley. He was also called the Blonde Ghost. He was also a CIA on a very high level. I mean, we're talking, these people went to the absolute highest level of the CIA during their careers. And another man was David Atlee Phillips. He was, like I say, in the end of his career, he was one of the absolute top people of the Western Hemisphere in the CIA. And he was also the so-called controller of Lee Harvey Oswald. But he was also the controller of one of the shooters, a man by the name of James Files, he was the guy at the grassy knoll behind the tree, behind the picket fence. And he was also the controller of a man called Michael Vernon Townley, who was involved in assassinations all over the world and was on location the night that the Swedish Prime Minister was shot, 1986, as well.
No coincidence there, yeah.
This is the thing, you know, these people, they're one thing, when you start looking into these things, you see, oh, that's a coincidence, or, oh, that's a coincidence. But
there,
when it comes to the coincidences in the hundreds and even thousands, you know, it just keeps repeating, then you come to a point where it's like you can't deny that there is a very definite pattern.
Right.
And that when these people pop up all over the place, when these things are carried out, then that is where I would say you should seriously look at it being proof that they're connected.
Definitely. And, I mean, once in a while, a cigar is a cigar. However, so-called coincidences, there's just not that many of them. When you really do, like you're doing, delving into it.
It's like when you go from country to country and you just find that the same people, if it's an assassination carried out in Cape Town, like the assassination of a very high politician in South Africa by the name of Robert Smith. When he is killed and the witnesses identify the exact same people that were in Dealey Plaza, the exact same people that were part of the Orlando Letier, when they blew him up in Washington. I don't know if you remember that.
No.
They were in Embassy Row, he was a former politician from Chile. And they blew him up with a car bomb in Washington, and that was the biggest internal terror act in the States before 9/11. But that was carried out by the same people, the same person who delivered the bomb. His name was Orlando Bosch. He was in Dealey Plaza that day when Kennedy was killed. He was also later sentenced for, I think it was about 270 different acts of terror.
Oh,
I mean, we're talking, that's the type of people I'm talking about. I mean, they're like, and that was what he was convicted of, you know?
Well, 270 and, some acts of terror. You just wonder how, even having the CIA as his protection, you wonder how he managed to do that much. My goodness.
In my book, I've got just to show what type of people we're talking about, I've got the different acts that he was sentenced for, and it's page up, page down, page up, page down. And it's anything from blowing up shops, you know, of people that were pro-Castro, to even airliners. They blew up one that killed, I think it was, I can't remember, but if it was 276 people or something like that. And they try to shoot at the UN building with a bazooka. It's like unreal what these people have been involved in. But it's the same people again and again and again and again.
Well, now some of these people, I mean, from way back with Kennedy 50 years ago, some of these people, they have to be pretty old or dead now.
They are in their early 80s, many of them, but they're still active. Some of them are still active.
They're still active? Wow.
They're still active. I know one that is being tracked down at the moment, and he has been carried out like one or two assassinations per week for all of these years. We're talking about 900 to 1,000 killings.
Loves his job, let's face it. This man, unless, I'm to ask you, do you think, I mean, when you say somebody is control or something, do you think that there's any type of mind control involved in these?
Yeah, of course. Some of these people, if not at least some of them, were picked very, very young, you know, when they were young teenagers, and started using, they started killing children to start with, you know, defenseless people or children.
Right.
In the way of for extortion and or to pressure people into do what they wanted them to do, so they went for the kids, And then they actually started with animals, and then they went to kids, and then young women, and then higher up. It's like an education, you know.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Some of these people were trained by some of the SS officers that was brought out by Operation Paperclip.
Right. After the Second World War. Yeah. Well, this is now Monarch, Operation Monarch. You're familiar with that? That started back in the 50s, didn't it?
No, all of them go hand in hand. It's not one separate
thing.
They go hand in hand.
Yeah.
And it's carried out by people. I mean, it's the same agenda, but just in different areas.
Yeah.
So it's and this is why it's so important to see how they're connected, because only then can you see the whole what is going on. Because at the moment, it looks like there's total madness going on. But it's the same small little group of people, but attacking from all different kind of directions at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So
they could diversify that way.
Yeah, totally.
Let me ask you, because people will always, I think, be interested in Lady Di.
Yeah.
What do you think was the purpose there?
She was taken out for sure. That I can give my right arm. That she was assassinated, but the reason
I believe that, but I'm not quite sure why, except that she was maybe having the baby of a person who was of color.
Yeah, but this is maybe a minor part of the whole thing, but that is absolutely not what, you know, they have a problem with people when they stand up and talk for when they stand for peace.
Yeah,
and it's somebody that people really listen to and respect and will do what they say. Then they have a problem, because this global elite, their agenda is death, war, and destruction. That's it.
Right.
That's where they make their billions. That's where they get the whole power and the energy, this awful energy they generate. That comes from that. And when somebody stands up, we got like people like John Lennon, Bob Marley, Lady Diana, Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King, JFK as well. And so these people were standing up for peace, and that was why they were taken out.
Okay.
And the specific one with Lady Diana, I think, was because she really started a campaign against landmines.
Mm-hmm.
And landmines are crucial to their agenda as well, because what they do is they go into a country, for instance. It's always because of drugs, oil, weapons, pedophile activity, or anything like that. When there is an invasion, or minerals, any type of that. It can also be because of the location. You know, they might need somewhere for their planes to land and refuel and take off again.
Or for pipelines to cross over from one country to the Gulf.
Yeah.
So,
but the thing is, they create some kind of conflict, or they have somebody that they're chasing, like a ghost person, like Bin Laden. I mean, that's the
fate.
I mean, he was dead in 2001, but they
I know.
They used him for the reason, why do we need to have troops down there? Why do we need to be, how can we disguise the reason why we're there?
Yeah.
And one of the things they do, for instance, in Afghanistan, is that they go to an area looking for this bearded guy with a turban who's been dead for years. But and what they go in there, and then they fight the local people, just trying to get them away from the place. And what they then do is that they just fill the whole area with landmines, and they disguise them, you know, sometimes with dolls and so that the kids will come and pick them up. It's absolutely horrific. But the reason for that is to get the population to back off and leave the area so that they can do whatever they came for without being disturbed.
Right.
And this is very often flying drugs out, transporting drugs out of that area. So the landmines are very, very big when it comes to how to take over a country and keep it to yourself, that part of the country. So when Lady Diana started really going for it, and I'm very ashamed to say that these mines are mostly made produced in a neutral country like Sweden. It is, come on, it's a massive joke.
I did not know that.
Oh, I tell you, it's really, really, I think it's disgraceful. But these landmines, nowadays they're not even made of metal anymore, but different
composites. Like plastics and things?
Yeah, so you can't detect them. So you know, you need to know exactly where they are to be able to find them. And if not, you will just be blown up, and this is what happens all the time. Because it can take like 30, 40 years to clear an area after they've been there.
As an aside, there is a group called Hero Rats, and I don't know if you've run across them. Rats have been trained to find them. And now that you said they're, now I don't know if the rats can find the plastic ones or not. The rats are not harmed in this, let me say, because they don't weigh enough to trip them. But they have been in several countries finding them. There's massive amounts of landmines in many countries, but they have been, this is an organization that is trying to find them without putting humans in danger.
Oh, that's wonderful.
It is. But now that you said that, I don't know if, I mean, they're still working, so I don't know if they're maybe working with the older, the metal ones, or maybe they've trained them now with plastic too. I don't know, but I do know the Hero Rats are doing a marvelous job of that.
That's amazing.
I know. Rats are super smart anyway. They're very cool. But
rats chasing rats, you could say.
Yeah, really, and giving a bad name to the four-legged ones is the problem. Because they're fine, but. So now they're getting slicker, doing the plastics or other newer compounds. So that would be Lady Di. Then that was probably, like you said, when people preach peace, it seems like a lot of them don't last a long time.
No. I feel strongly that you are such a person. I am myself. And we are the people that will be, if not already, are being looked upon as future terrorists. But that is how they label it. You know, truth seekers are now being labeled as terrorists.
Yeah, isn't that bizarre? I mean, how that word has changed totally.
No, but they're using these words to play ping pong with people's brains.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the same thing. They call all these fancy war strategies, like they call them Operation Freedom or Operation Stardust or something like that, when the actual words would be Operation Slaughter, Operation Rape and Plunder. That would be more like it.
That would be more apt, for sure. Yeah.
It's just so sad with all these soldiers and people in uniform who are not aware of whose agenda they're working for. It's a real tragedy, I would say.
I think that's a very good word for it, because I know there's still people who join the military because they think that they're protecting my freedom, right? I live in the United States, so they join, and you know, my freedom has never been in question except from the government here, as far as, you know, nobody in any other country is threatening me. And I've been in several fights with people we don't like to say, oh, we were wrong. And so, you know, they try to back up the fact that they're going off to fight or that their kids are or something. Well, it's for your freedom. And I'm always like, well, it has nothing to do with my freedom. But they have been sucked into this.
Yeah.
And they believe it. They actually believe it. And then you get some of these, now we're having a mass of suicides because, you know, people come back, they think about what they've done, they can't live with it.
No. And, you know, on many shows, I don't know how many shows I've been on.
I know you've been on tons of shows.
Yeah.
Yes.
And many times I speak directly to soldiers, to people in uniform, and to the elite as well, addressing them, you know, because I'm not one to point fingers or blame or anything. Like, I'm just trying to get them awakening into informing themselves about whose agenda it is they're serving, because they are the ones that will have to live with this blood on their hands. It's
exactly.
Their soul that they're soiling with these awful acts, and it's because of greed that is not even theirs. You know, they're just being used as cannon fodder and a total tool.
Yeah.
And so anyone that I can wake up or become aware of, I'm very grateful if anyone. And I know there is a great awakening among these people as well, because the thing is that this global elite, this little, they're only like a couple of thousand. It's a small group of so-called powerful people. But we're 7 billion. So it's an absolute joke why we let them control us. And even worse, we're controlling ourselves. That is the massive madness in the whole thing.
Yeah. Because people somehow, just like poor pick on poor, it's so bizarre. Now, some soldiers are really on top of it. In Israel, we have a group of ex-IDF people, and their organization is called Breaking the Silence, and they're talking about the horrid things that they did towards Palestinians. I have friends who say that we need something like that in this country, but actually we have things in this country because we do have veterans. We have a couple who are just touring and speaking out.
Mm.
And I mean, that's a good thing. When it comes from veterans in whatever country, people seem to listen a little bit more because they have done this and they've seen it and they regret it.
Yeah.
So anything like that. You mentioned radio shows. I did want to say that you've been a guest on so many shows. Varietas with Mel Fabregas. You've been on The Real Deal. You've been on No Lies Radio with Kevin Barrett. USA Super Who Radio. Red Ice Creations. Project Camelot. Global Peace Radio. Open Your Mind. Talk Radio Europe. Freedom Radio in Denmark. You have just been on so many different shows because you have good, solid info from all these years. And I wanted to ask you, now you have a book out, Coup d'etat in Slow Motion. Where can that be found?
It will hopefully be available within before New Year or around New Year on Amazon and many of the other major online bookstores.
Okay.
It's been
for the New Year's. Okay.
Yeah, it's in the printing process at the moment. It's the first time this book has been finished for 12 years or something like that.
Oh my goodness.
but I haven't been able to find anyone with the guts. And now today there's a company in the States, a small publishing company who has the guts to do it.
Okay.
So I take my hat off. I salute her, for the owner of this company, to do that.
Definitely, because if it's anything like, you know, the way you speak and your articles, I mean, she's brave, but thank God. We need this. Yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree. And the thing is, you were talking about conspiracy theories and so on. For me, I'm not interested in theories at all.
No.
I look for acts. I go to a crime scene. I look for the facts. I've got a Farmer Brown logic where 1 + 1 = 2.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter if you got a fine white robe and a long title and you tell me that it equals 34. I just know that it's not the truth.
Right.
There is a truth to be found at any site, and it's always more or less 100% of the times behind of these things, there is a definite reason why it was carried out. So it's just a matter of finding and putting together the jigsaw. It can be very complex sometimes, but I'm just doing what the police should have been doing in the first time. The sad thing is that the part of the police, or at least the power that controls them, are very often, if not always, directly involved in it.
Right. So they're totally at odds with you finding the truth. But you're right. These are not random acts.
No.
And I mean, of course, they want you to believe that. Oh, that's just, and like you said, it's always some crazy guy.
If you want to, I can explain exactly how one of these things are carried out.
Please.
And then you can, like a template, then you can just, the next time it happens, you can just say, oh, Hawk, that's point one, point two, point three. Would you like that?
Please. And
okay.
Tell me, you would put Sandy Hook in this, wouldn't you?
Yeah, God, yeah.
Definitely, yeah. That was my first thing when I first heard about it. And I couldn't believe that I also got into fights with people about that because they've refused to, they just don't want to hear it. But go up, please, tell us, point by point. Yes.
No, you know, in the old days, in the early 60s and back in the 50s, the thing is that false flag operation has been used since the Roman Empire.
Yes.
You know, that's the way to carry it out. And the reason, let me give an example. If, for instance, if you look at a coup d'etat in, let's take Chile or one of these South American countries, these coups were actually not internal things. They were backed by the U.S. and totally, I must say that the U.S. has been an extreme bully when it comes on the international level.
Yeah.
And anyway, but what happened there was that they went in, the U.S. went in and backed the military force to take over. So what happened was that the military did a violent coup that could take like a day or maybe overnight, maybe a couple of two, 3 days. And after that, poof, they were into power. They killed everybody who was there was president and other high-ranking people. They were killed. And they were in the position of power. But what happened then was that they had massive problems with the population. They had problems with demonstrations. They had problems with guerrilla movements. They had problems with, free thinkers and people mm-hmm. just reacting. There were also problems with international boycotts and so on. So what they had to do was they had to put an extreme military force out there making mass arrests, and they filled the prisons, they filled the stadiums, they tortured them to find out where the rest was hiding, and then they killed them, and when they killed them, they had problems with their families and relatives, so they had to arrest them too, and then it just, in the end, they had to have almost as much military power in the streets as there were people. So that was not the way to go. That's a very messy and very clumsy way to go.
Right.
So what you do instead is that you use an old Roman tactic called problem, reaction, solution.
Ah, yes.
Because instead of you forcing something, you want the population to welcome it. You welcome it. This is
right.
The whole thing. So what you do is, now we come to this template. For instance, nowadays, the two favorites they use, it's bombs or mass shootings. The mass shootings is to create the illusion that it's the weapons that is the problem.
Yes.
We need to get
yes.
rid of the weapons.
Right.
So they would say, all of these shootings, oh my God, it's the weapon. It's not because you can only shoot one bullet that would kill, but that you can shoot 40 bullets. Okay, it's the problem is the 40 bullets. It's not that some crazy person is shooting or why he's shooting, so it's the weapon.
Right.
So with the mass shootings, what they're trying to do is create this illusion of a problem so that the reaction from people would be, oh my God, we need to get rid of the weapons, and their agenda would be to take over the weapons and then take over your country.
Yes.
But when it comes to bombs, which is has been a favorite for quite a while here now, it used to be fly hijackings, but now it's bombs. So what you do, for instance, like let me say I'm the one in power in Spain, for instance, and I want the police to have the same military power that is now reality in the States, which would have been a joke if you had talked about it like 15 years ago before 9/11. Nobody would have believed you, but
yeah.
they have used this tactic to get to where they are now. But so I'm in Spain, and what I want the police to drive around in tanks, more or less. I want them to look like Robocops. I want them to be able to kick in doors, have drones that can kill people at any time, anywhere. I would want to be able to attain people without them having an access to a lawyer and put them away on indefinite until whatever.
Yeah.
That is what I want. if I just force that on the Spanish people, I can do that. I just drive out the police, I buy them some tanks and all these things, I would have a massive problem. We're back to the same thing as what happened in South America. I would have a lot of problems with all of the uprising, guerrilla movements, demonstrations, international boycotts, trading problems, all of these things. So that's not the way to do it. The way to do it is to create a problem. And this problem is very often in the shape of a bomb. Why a bomb? Because a bomb is one of these things that can make a massive impact, because you need a massive emotional impact.
Yes.
Okay, so what I do is I place this bomb, and it needs to be placed carefully. It needs to be in a public place and not like in an old people's home or in a hospital for war veterans or something like that. No, 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 no. The key word is women and children, because it's the women and children that will create the most emotional impact. Okay, so I place the bomb near in a public place so that everybody will feel threatened. It could have been me.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, where there's some kind of daycare center or some kind of something with women and children. Nuns are a favorite as well, or nurses. These works really well internationally. So what you do is, in the meantime, while I prepare this bomb, I also prepare a patsy. This patsy is most of the time somebody I don't like anyway, I have some kind of a problem with, or it could be a little group of Mormons or yogis or you name it, green parrot lovers or militant pig farmers, or you make it up. It's not real anyway.
Yeah.
And then you say about these pig farmers, or let's take yogis, for instance, they have meetings on Tuesday, and they're listening to this bearded guy, and they trust what he says, and they will follow. If he says go there, they will go there. Okay, so you start spreading out this in media, just pumping it out slowly to prepare the subconscious of people that, ooh, that's a bit of a strange group. And then you leak out that, maybe they have some kind of, surveillance thing, and maybe they have weapons underneath the yoga hall or something like that. Okay, so you prepare the subconscious of people saying, that's a weird group. Okay, so that leaks out in media in the weeks up to this event. Okay, so you prepare that. At the same time, you prepare evidence that will point that way. And nowadays, it's ridiculous. I mean, if it's the Muslims, they're trying to blame it on, it would be a Quran or an instructional video on how to fly a 757, from 9, and it's just so badly done. But anyway, I mean, who writes these scripts? I don't know, but it's like on a kid's level sometimes. So you prepare something very obvious, like, for instance, if it was the yogis, maybe a false beard and a turban and some orange robes or something like that would be found right next to the bomb.
Yeah.
And point that away, okay?
Yeah.
Then in the meantime, while you do that, you prepare. So you got the patsy ready, you got the evidence ready that is pointing that way. And then what you also do is that I prepare the investigation that will take care of it. This investigation will be on standby and only be made up with people that I control, because their job is not to find what actually happened, but just to point at the patsy.
They went that away.
And also, when somebody like myself approaches them or start digging, the investigation will also deal with somebody like me. But they are not put there to find out the truth.
No.
Okay. So it's very important to see that these things are connected. You know, when you see something happens and then you see, oh, but thank God they put an investigation there. Check out who is in the investigation. And then what also happens is, once it's done, And the investigation, where their aim is not to find the truth, so that will just be dragging out until we're so fed up with it in the end that we don't really care anymore. But if somebody keeps pushing for the truth, keeps pushing, what they will do is they will put a commission there, a truth commission, or something like that commission, or something like this commission. And that commission's task is only to divert divert attention. So they will not look at the crime itself, but they will look at the first investigation, and then they will drag it out for about a year, writing thousands of documents that says absolutely nothing, and then they would say in the end, they would come out with a report saying, well, the investigation, they really did their best, but they failed on this point and this point and this point. But we, as the commission, has done a great job, but unfortunately we couldn't do anything better than that. Okay,
right.
Fine. Then if the public says, but come on, this, you didn't do anything, then if that keeps on and on, they will appoint another committee, and the second committee will look into the first committee, not into the crime, but the first thing, and it will just drag out and drag out, and sometimes they divert attention as well by creating small scandals within the commission so that, you know, they need to restart the whole job or they need to delay it. The whole point is to delay and delay and delay, so people are so fed up that in the end they have absolutely lost interest of finding out what the truth is about the whole thing.
Well, the two that come to mind would be like the Warren Commission about President Kennedy, and then the 9/11 Commission. They were both jokes.
Absolute jokes.
Yeah.
But they're filling their purpose. If you see why they were put there, they were doing a great job, because their job was not to find the truth, and
no,
they didn't.
No. True. They did their job. Yeah.
They did their job. But also, so you got the patsy, you got the bomb in place, you got the evidence prepared, and you got your own investigation on standby. Then what you do is you carry out a drill at the exact same time as the event is taking place.
Yep.
That drill is carried out because that is the way to get the explosives in place without people really noticing what they're doing, you know. And also to get patsies in position. They think that they're part of a film shoot or some kind of a staged event, or they, you know, all of them, I would say more or less all of them have been trained by the FBI when it comes to the states, financed and all of these things by the FBI. And so these people, without knowing it, are put into place with these drills so that when it goes live, suddenly, boom, it goes live, they're the ones being pointed at.
Yeah.
Okay, so everything is set and the time has come for the big bang. So what you do is you have media, which I control to a large extent. I have them on standby. Everything is on standby. And then I wait until when people are really vulnerable. It doesn't work at late evening or in the middle of the night. No, I wait in the morning hours.
Yeah.
You know, people have just woken up. They've just had breakfast. You know, they're going with the kids to the school. So very often it's around 9:15, 9, somewhere there where there are lots of people in the subways and so on, so that they will feel vulnerable as well, or that it could have been them. And then I say, okay, boom, off goes the bomb. And then I spread out all these horrific images of blown up children and women and blood and all of these things in media, out, to create the reaction. That was the problem. Here comes the reaction. For the public to see, oh my God, something needs to be done.
Yes.
And then they turn towards me, who they appointed to do this job, and say, come on, you need to get these yogis. My God, because media has been pointing right away. You will see that within 10 minutes after the explosion, media will start pointing. If it's not Bin Laden, then it's someone else who they're joking. Before they even officially know who was involved, they're pointing. So in this case, they will be pointing at the bearded guy group in the yoga hall, saying, my God, something needs to be done, something needs to be done. They turn towards me, and I say, well, the only way I can deal with this, if you really want me to do it, I need tanks in the street, police like Robocops, giving them total authority to kick in doors, do whatever. And people just say, yes, do it. And so I move my whole force in there. Nowadays, I start martial law as well.
Yeah.
Also, one thing that happens is I shut down communication so that when the blast goes off, more or less all communication stops. You know, mobile phones doesn't work anymore, telephone lines.
Mm.
And they say that is because so many are calling to their friends to see, are you okay? Are you okay? No. If you go back to the JFK assassination and many of these other ones, with the JFK, the whole telephone system for one solid hour went down when the shots were fired from one hour.
Wow.
The whole
know
thing.
That.
Yeah, and on the same time, you have troops in the air, airborne troops that are on standby, just rotating in the air so that if there are riots anywhere, they will just land and deal with these things. So, okay, and then I have martial law for a while, and to get people used to seeing soldiers in the street, tanks mm-hmm. in the street, that they get used to it, and I get hold of these poor yogis, I put them away forever, mm-hmm. and sometimes I might shoot one or two of them just to make, oh, you know, he was the one who did it.
Make it look good, right.
Yeah, make it look good, and then this guy can't defend himself because he's got a hole in his head. So that's a great one to do that as well. And the thing is, I would be welcomed by a hero. I was the one who dealt with these horrible yogis. And also what I do, I leave these soldiers there, and then when I withdraw after 2-3 weeks, for your security, I leave them there for your safety. Then when I withdraw, I leave about 20% of them there.
Yeah.
Hmm. And this is what they do. They step it up, but so you don't notice how they're doing it. So mm-hmm. People are getting more and more used to all these surveillance cameras, all these armed cops, you name it. I mean, we're living in science fiction land at the moment.
Yeah.
And these beautiful surveillance cameras, they're amazing. They will track down everything except when it's actually happening. Then all of the cameras are turned off.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, this
funny
is standard,
how that works. Yeah.
Standard with all of these, when they carry these operations out, all cameras stop working.
Yeah.
And if they still work, the FBI will come and confiscate the films for
right.
your security.
For your
national
security.
Security.
Right. And then we know now how easily it is to doctor things. So they may then let out a little bit of that film, but it's already been doctored. So, you know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't count for anything. Anyway, well, you really have it down, Ole. You've been working on this long enough, so you've got the whole thing really step by step, all the checkpoints.
Sometimes, around the assassination of the Swedish Prime Minister, it's been so sloppy, you know, really, really, they got their dates wrong, they got, you know, when they had to present evidence, and it's just doctored, and it's just, and sometimes I just felt, oh, God, I'm going to go there and say, come on, guys, employ me instead, I know what to look for, I can sort it out for you. I'm joking now, but I just feel because they're so sloppy, also because, you know, if you or I would do a horrible crime or something like that, we would do our best to cover our butt, you know. But these people know, they know that they will not be taken out, you know. They know that they're safe, so they don't really put that effort into it.
Yeah, and that's just sort of, like you say, I mean, it's sort of an offense somehow to people who think. It's like you think that we aren't going to notice all these discrepancies, but they don't care.
But we haven't for so many years.
That's it. Yeah.
You say I'm on top of things. It's only because I've been doing this for 30 years. People are waking up now. I've been down the road for 30 years. That's the only difference. But and that's why I feel what I come forward with can be of value.
Yeah.
So
well, I agree, and I wanted to ask you because you devote so much of your time to this. Is this like your articles? And things, is this your only income? Do you take donations? How are you financed?
I am not, and this is a big problem. I say I really reach out if anyone wants to sponsor me or help me or in my efforts, because I'm not going to stop until this world is united. This is my like Bob Marley said, I'm a simple man with a simple wish. I just want to unite mankind.
that's it's a simple wish and it's not easy. So
who said it's easy?
Exactly. Nobody said it was easy. Yeah.
I just want to do my part. If I can pull my little load in any way, that is why I'm here. But financially, I don't get any pay from radio interviews, articles, anything. I don't get financed at all. So if anybody's believes in what I'm doing, I would be extremely grateful for all types of donations or sponsorship. There are on my website, there are donation buttons and so on. So
right. I wanted to say that this is www.lightonconspiracies.com, and you can find out so much more about Ole and what he's doing. My goodness, man. All of these things that you've looked into, it's amazing. Do people call you up with tips and things like that?
They started to, but many of the people that contact me now are disinformers. You know, they're trying to.
Right.
So nowadays, especially with the internet, it's very hard to, or you really need to check your facts before you go for a thing, because there's so much put out there on purpose to divert your attention, and especially in this conspiracy world, I mean, my God, there's so much out there. It's very hard for normal people to know what is true and what isn't.
Yeah.
So I'm just doing my best to connect the dots.
Well, I say you're doing a good. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I could just mention a few of these people in Operation 40
Yes.
Because if you take, for instance, one of them, his name was David Morales. He was in Dealey Plaza. He was one of the higher officers in Operation 40. He was in Dealey Plaza. He was not one of the shooter, but he was there. He was also at the Ambassador Hotel when Robert Kennedy was assassinated. He was also in Bolivia when they tracked down Che Guevara. He was the one who actually killed him.
Oh, really?
But the guy who was put in charge to track down Che Guevara was a man from Operation 40. His name was Felix, he's still alive as far as I know, Felix Rodriguez. He was also deeply involved in the Watergate burglar. He was in Operation 40, and he was one of the key people working with Oliver North in the Iran-Contra scandal.
Oh, my goodness. He got around.
Yeah. And he was also George Bush Sr.'s right hand when it came to all of these black operations. By the way, Oliver Bosch, you know the guy with all of these 200 and how many
I was
going to
ask
you if there's
He was pardoned,
and guess by who? George W. Bush.
Yeah,
Bush Sr. And George Bush Sr. in Dealey Plaza, they're more or less bulletproof evidence now that he was actually inside the Deltex building when the shots were fired. The shooter from the Deltex building, his name was Chucky Nicoletti. I mean, we're talking about multiple shooters here. I can name them all if you want, but I'll just go into the Deltex building. Wow. In that room, the shooter's name was Chucky Nicoletti. He was a hitman from the Chicago mob. The spotter, his name was, it was a black guy from Operation 40, or close to Operation 40. His name was Nestor Izquierdo. There's a statue of him in Miami as well.
Yeah.
And then you had Johnny Rosselli, who was the connect person between the Chicago mob and the CIA. He was in that room as well, and George Bush. Because George Bush Sr. was the, I don't know what you call that in English, but like the paymaster of Operation 40. He was put there to bring in the money to finance this group.
Oh.
But we're talking about, so that's why you need to study history to see that these people, do you know, like they're white-haired and they look very nice on TV and so on, and they're in the White House now.
They're evil.
Where did they come from? You need to track them back down. And one of the other people from Operation 40 who was very, very active as an assassin, his name was Porter Goss, and he was later the chief of the CIA under George Bush Jr.
Okay, so it becomes very incestuous then.
It does. Then you got another one. His name was Barry Seals. He was a pilot who flew some of the hitmen into Dealey Plaza. He was also one of the key pilots in the whole Operation Iran-Contras scandal, where they flew out weapons to the Contras in Nicaragua and brought back tons and tons and tons of drugs into the States. And the one of the airports they used, it wasn't really an airport, it was like an airstrip, was in a small town called Mena in Arkansas.
I was gonna say, at that time,
at that time there was a governor there by the name of
Bill Clinton.
With a very nice, I wouldn't say so, wife called Hillary Clinton. And yeah. Bill Clinton and his partner, his name was, I forgot that one. He had a partner as well. And they were the ones receiving these drugs and then spreading it out. He was just the governor at that time before he was invited to a Bilderberg meeting. And then they decided that this guy works president. Good on media.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And he was getting, you know, when they get invited to these Bilderberg meeting and so on, if they approved of, their career just skyrockets.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So, and then he's been trying to cover his tracks for many years and with lots of so-called suicides and killings. And so not a very nice picture at all.
No. I remember Vince Foster.
I can just tell you one thing that most people don't know. You know when Oklahoma City was taken out, the bomb in Oklahoma City?
Mm-hmm.
This was one of these problem reaction solution.
Yes.
But the reason, as far as I know, that they picked this building, not just because there were kids and so on there, but it was the Alfred P. Murray building. For one thing, he was a Freemason before, and I think there was a lot of insurance money being paid out from when after they
did.
Often these buildings they're doomed somehow. You know, there's too much of toxic things in the basement or something like that. You know, so they're gonna tear it down anyway. So instead, they blow it up and then they get millions in insurance company. But what happened there was that. After the first bombs had exploded, there were, you know, people came from everywhere trying to pull out the wounded and so on out of the rubble and so on. And then somebody shouted out, "No, secondary bombs! There are secondary bombs! Everybody has to move out! Everybody has to move out!" So people had to leave these poor victims dying there, and just move out because there were these extra explosives hidden. They said. But what happened was that there were two vans coming and a lot of guys in blue overalls came out. And what they did was they went straight for the office cabinets in the rubble. And they got them out. They got all of these and there were some papers flying around. They collected everything, put it in the vans, took off. And then danger over, you know, safe to come back again. So people can't back. And the paper that was collected there, all these files, had come straight from MENA the day before, because that was paper, documents, that was aimed to be used against Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton in the Black River scandal.
So
you see, once again, one of these so-called coincidences.
Yeah, we know there aren't any. Ole, we're going to have to stop. And please, will you come back again?
For sure.
I mean,
you
have so much. Until then, please, listeners, go to lightonconspiracies.com. And you find out a lot more. There's a donation button. You'll find out exactly when in the new year the Coup d'etat in slow motion book comes out. And there will be other access to so many of the articles that he's written. I want to just thank you so very, very much. I've learned a lot, and I didn't start from nowhere because I've known some of this, but you have really taught me a lot. So I thank you very much.
I thank you, Ruth. And can I just end with what I think is a beautiful thing?
Sure.
I've got a yoga teacher, Raja yoga teacher, not yoga for the body. I'm stiff like a log, but the science of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
And she often finishes with a beautiful, beautiful prayer. And she says, "May the entire universe be filled with peace and joy, love and light. May everyone, and especially the ones who heard us, be filled with peace and joy, love and light. Victory to that light." And this is something I truly believe in. I am not here to spread fear or hate or any of that. I'm here to help heal the world, you know.
Yes. Yes.
And we're not in a time to blame. It's just a matter of we need to expose it to stop this madness that is going on and heal this world with love. That's the one.
You're right.
And I'm super optimistic about the future, I tell you.
I am too. I really am.
I'm so happy to hear that.
But yeah, I am. I'm like the eternal optimist. Ole, thank you. And that was a beautiful way to end. So, yes, victory to the light. Thank you.
Thank you.